Welcome inside the Legends Lounge, where baseball VIPs are hanging out and talking about their life in the game.
Alana, here's a serious one coming up, and this is someone who I did not know a ton about, aside from, you know, bits and pieces of him from his playing days, but we're about to go very in-depth with Jason Grimsley, who is an open book, and there is a book about his life.
Yeah, you know, I didn't know a ton about him either, but the thing is, he's a two-time World Series champion, and we talk about this, obviously, in this podcast, but it's the least interesting thing about him, if you can believe that.
Mm-hmm. And I remember the PED situation, which, you know, he touches on pretty quickly, but that is what he's known for, I think, in certain aspects where they're like, oh, wasn't he involved with the Mitchell report or whatever? And it's like, you know, there is so much more to the Jason Grimsley story that should be known. So let's get into it right now. Year big leaguer coming through, most of his time spent with the Yankees and the Royals, close to 1,000 innings for the relief pitcher, and also two World Series titles with the 99 and 2000 Yanks. And his life's been a movie. That's why there's a book, a must read. And before we eventually get to the movie, I'm sure someday, it's out there now for pre-order. By the time you're listening to this, it might even be able to just straight up order and have it at your doorstep, you know, Amazon, wherever, in 5 seconds. It's called Cross Stitched. Jason Grimsley wrote it. He's in the lounge. Jason, congrats on the book release. How's life?
Hey, life's good. Life's great. My all three kids are out of college, so I just got a pay raise.
Maybe you can get back into the black, out of the red, huh? Now that all three kids are gone.
It's going to be a while. But daughter's getting married in next December. My youngest is getting married next December, so excited about that. Grandkids growing like a weed. So we're just living life, having a good time, and trying to put one foot in front of the other, so to speak, and just enjoy what time I have left on this great place we call the earth.
Well, you know, you have three kids, two boys and one girl that you just mentioned getting married, and you have two World Series titles. And what's crazy is that, you know, Jason, that is one of the most coveted titles anybody that could have. And I find that it's almost the least interesting thing about you, if that's even possible, because if you take a look at Cross Stitched, the book that's coming out, obviously you wrote it with Jason Clark, and I'm showing the viewers, the listeners and the viewers, the book now. It's incredible. I mean, some near-death experiences, just some real-life lessons. And I would imagine, too, and I want it from your words, not from mine, but some vulnerability had to have gone into putting this on paper. Can you take me through the thought process of why you wanted to get it out there?
The main reason I wrote the book was, if I had the ability to help one person that's going through anything similar to what I went through at any stage of my life, especially towards the end and when things got really dark, shame on me for not doing that. I was given so much from this game of baseball. I'm redneck from East Texas, a place called Target and Prairie. I worked on a farm, baled hay, fixed fence. And if you'd have told me a week before I got drafted that I was going to have a chance to play big league baseball, I'd have laughed at you. But, you know, it's such a great game. It's our national pastime, and I've loved it since I was 5 years old, I think, 5 or 6 years old. And I just want to point out the pitfalls, and I know people are still gonna make mistakes. That's not why I wrote the book, just came from that, but just to help them navigate and try to not get away from who you are, where you're from, and what your identity actually is. You know, I thought for a long time my entire identity was baseball. You know, I played till I was 39. That's all I did since I was 7. Then when baseball was done, you know, I had a hole in the middle of me. I couldn't feel anything. And I just want guys that are out there, I don't care if it's baseball, I don't care if it's a business, I don't care what it is, man, woman. What you do does not identify who you are. Now that's not where our identity is built. I firmly believe our identity is built in our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. I got personal experience to that, but it's a way for me to give back. It's a way. All I want to do now is help. You know, I took so much. I was extremely selfish when I played, both with my family and with my friends, and I just want to give back. I want to help.
Alana, this is right up your alley, because we talk about this all the time when we do these interviews. Is just humanizing. Yeah. Very simple word that goes a long way for people that were involved with the game mostly for their entire life. So continuing on the book, Jason, first off, I just want to add this, because maybe you can let he or she know the cover is awesome. You're not supposed to judge the book by the cover, but it's art. Art is intriguing. If I stop, you know, if I see that somewhere, you say in the airport, I'm in. Catches my eye. The color is unique. The baseball is sick. So I'm very in on that. Really, yeah. Well done. Well,
there's a great story behind that as well.
Oh, yeah. All right. I'm ready for it.
From the name of the book to how the cover come into being. Yeah. I was in New Jersey. I just gone to Zeno, Ohio to Athletes in Action. George McGovern, who's the chaplain with the Yankees and the other sports teams in New York, mentor of mine, great man, had called me, and he had been in touch with me after my near the time I came close to committing suicide and going through that rehab process. Afterwards, George McGovern, and up to that point, kept in touch with me, was a great mentor of mine. And they asked me to go to Zeno, Ohio, so to this Athletes in Action to help introduce kids to Christ through sports. Because he knew I was helping coach teams, and he wanted to introduce me to that. And we go up there, and I'd never told my story before. And there's 50 of us in there, they busted up in groups of seven, and we're sitting around, and guys are talking about themselves a little bit, and no idea, no reason, feeling I need to tell everybody everything. Mm-hmm. Those seven guys in that group, and I just told my story from beginning to end. And when I finished, nobody said anything. Everybody just looking at me. Mm-hmm. One of the guys in my group is named Q Rim, and his wife's dad has a church in New Jersey. He passed away in the last couple of years, but I was with him, and he looked at me and he said, "Jason, you got to tell your story." I said, "I just did." He said, No. You got to get out there. I want you to come to our church and tell your story." I said, "Well, I don't speak. I'm not a speaker." He said, "No, it doesn't matter. You're going to come tell your story." So that started the process. So I went and told my story, and there was a man and a lady in the audience, George and Elizabeth Nader. She's an author. She's got a big podcast. She's a strong Christian woman. She badgered me in with her and my wife to write this book. And so we're having a meeting at her house to go over. She's like, "We got to come up with a name." And we get done talking about it, everybody's excited. So I want to pray. So she started praying, and I've never had a vision. I've never heard God's voice. But when we're praying, I had my eyes closed, and in my mind, big white letters in that font came up cross-stitched.
Wow.
And so we got done, and I said, "I got it." They said, "You got what?" I said, "I got the title of the book." And she looked at me and just sort of smirked. I said, "No, cross-stitched." And jaws hit the floor. They said, "That's perfect." I said, "Okay, we got to come up with a book cover." And immediately I said, I know the guy I want to do it. Mark Tremonti, the guitarist with Creed and Alter Bridge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. His brother... His brother does all their album work, and I loved their album covers. It's always somebody reaching something dark to light coming out. And I said, I'm gonna call Mark's brother. So I gave him a call, and we're on the phone, And he says, Jason, I just got to tell you, I've always wanted to put an old beat up baseball on a book cover. I just want to tell you that.
Get out of here.
And so we started talking, and you know, asked him if he was a believer, and he said, yeah. And he started telling me a story about their mom had passed away. And I knew that by being real close with Mark. And he was with her, and he was just mad at God, basically. And the story he told really, really touched me. You know, he was mad, and he was talking to God. You know, how can you exist if you let a woman like this go through what she's going through? And his mom was in hospice, and she hadn't spoken. She was in basically, they were just keeping her comfortable. And she looked at him and said, son, he's real. He's right here, right now. And when he said that, I got goosebumps all over my body. And I just love the way this was, this whole story and this whole idea behind the book. And when we decided to do it, it was just moment after moment after moment after moment of things happening. And that's where the book came from, the book design.
That's an incredible story. I mean, I'm glad that Scott brought that up, because we probably wouldn't have even gone down that path. But it is such a perfect cover with the combination, of course, of the cross and the baseball. And cross stitch is such an interesting name for it, too. And I want to, you know, some of the excerpts about it, when you look at the release for it, Jason, it says, from a hilarious story about scaling the outside of a hotel at 3 a.m. to a botched suicide attempt. And we obviously are glad that it was botched and that you didn't do it well. What got you to that place? What was going on in your life?
Everything. It was just from the time I was, oh, heck, I think I was 5 years old. I was molested for a couple of years. And didn't tell anybody until I was 48 after the botched suicide attempt. That, in 2005, my wife's little brother, who I was extremely close to, killed himself. And he called me about a half hour before it happened, and I went around my phone, and I didn't have my phone, and he left me a message, and I kept that message for 20 years. Well, not 20 years, about 8, well, up until a couple of years ago, and I'd listen to it, and, you know, I always thought there was something I could do. That, baseball ended like it did with the FBI raid and the Mitchell report and all that stuff. And, you know, I just wanted to disappear. And I'd been to rehab, got mad at the world because I thought everybody could go out, drink, have fun. I couldn't. ended up in a psych ward after that, because of the same thing. And got to the point to where I thought the world would be better off without me. My wife, my kids would be better off without me. Got an ounce of cocaine, about half a dozen bottles of vodka. And after 3 days, that didn't work. So I said, all right, I'm going to do it the right way. Took my pistol, went out in the woods, turned around, looked at it, put it over my left eye, cocked the trigger, pulled the trigger, gun didn't go off.
Wow. And,
that began the process of, I said, all right, God, you won't let me live, you won't let me die, what do you want me to do? And the turning point in all this was after I got out of that rehab that time, came back home, and I was leaving. I didn't want to expose my wife and my kids to any more of my nonsense, so to speak. I thought they'd be better off without me. And found an apartment. And the day before I was going to move in the apartment, my wife came to me and showed me grace like no other human being ever has. She looked at me and said, none of this works without you. She said, I forgive you. I know God's forgiven you. Now you got to forgive yourself. And that started the process of the healing and God's work in my life. And immediately she wanted me to write a book. She said, you got to tell your story. And I put her off. because I wanted nothing about the limelight. I didn't want to be about me. I didn't want to be in front of a camera and a newspaper, nothing. And God let me know in Zeno, Ohio in 2017. George McGovern called me up when I went there, and he said, all right, tell your story. And then the reaction I got from it was just affirmation that, all right, I need to do this. And another affirmation of that, I was speaking at a church in San Manuel, Arizona. A good friend of mine, Dwayne Adams, is a hunting guide, and he and I became really good friends. And he asked me to come speak at his church, so I went to speak at his church. This has been probably a year and a half ago. And get up and I speak to the first service, and before this, I didn't really like speaking in public. Now I absolutely love telling my story. I love talking to people about it. And the pastor afterwards asked me to like come down to the front, to the call to the front. Well, the first service, a man walks up and he reaches his back pocket and he hands me a metal cross. And he said, I brought this today, and I don't know why I brought it, but I know why. He said, I never knew, and his wife was with him, and he said, we never knew how our son felt. Now we know. And he gave me the cross. He said, I don't know why I'm giving you this, but I'm giving you this. And I thanked him. And do the second service, go down the front for the call again. And there's a lady in her mid-30s that's just sitting there by herself after everybody's gone. And you can tell she don't want to get up. But she gets up, she comes up, and she looks at me, and she says, I'm where you are right now. I'm where you were right now. She said, I thought about killing myself last night, this morning. God told me to come to church. Something told me to come to church. I came. You were here. I didn't know you were going to be here. I heard what you had to say. And I reached in my back pocket. I said, the gentleman gave me this a little bit earlier, and he didn't know why. I know why now. Shared Christ with her and got her connected with a couple people there. But that was just more affirmation that I need to get out and tell people about the good news that is out there. You know, people ask me, you know, do you have trouble telling it? Is it tough telling it? Sometimes it's tough. I still get choked up every once in a while telling it. But it's not my story. It happened to me, but it's not my story. It didn't begin with me. It's not going to end with me. You know, and if we could get just a little bit of that every day in our lives, you know, why not? I'm going to do what I can to talk to as many people as I can, do what I can to help. I don't know what else I can do or where I'm going to end up, but I just know the journey I'm on. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm not going to say I'm content, but I think I'm probably happier than I've ever been in my life.
Well, you're doing it, Jason. I mean, you're impacting lives. This, like you said, this is being done for a reason. What you're doing it from a writing a book perspective, to be able to reach people that, you know, you'd never get to reach, of course, doing interviews like this. Also, you're a fantastic speaker. So immediately I'm thinking too, I'm like, hey, I wasn't covering the game in the 90s there. And even in the early 2000s, the few years opening up the 2000s, you're in the game. What were you like? Were you not a talker? You know, how much? We talked to you for 5 hours. I mean, you know, my producer eventually gonna text me like, yo, we have time limitations here, but I'm locked in. So take me for at least a couple minutes inside Jason Grimsley during your playing days, because clearly, like you said, you've changed exponentially in almost, you know, every way from personality traits.
Yeah, I was extremely I guess from the abuse when I was younger. When I was molested, I built walls. I wouldn't let anybody get too close. I didn't realize at the time, but I did everything I can to prepare myself to where nobody was going to ever be able to take advantage of me again. Martial arts for 12, 14 years. Had no problem using it. I was extremely reactionary. I think from that, I was, from what happened to me when I was young, I was always a protector. If something was happening to somebody and they couldn't take care of themselves, I was going to jump in. Even from a young age, I did that. And when I got older and I was able to handle myself in a certain manner, nobody's going to take advantage of me, my loved ones, anybody that cared about that's around me. If something happened, I was going to be the first one in the fray. There's a part of me that wanted people to fear me on the field and off the field. And I don't think it was conscious. I think it was a part of my subconscious that was doing that. You know, you can talk to my teammates that I played with. They love me. I'd do anything for them. Like I said, I was the first one in the fight. I was the first one to stand up for them. I wouldn't allow any nonsense to go on the baseball field or in the clubhouse. You know, if something was wrong, I'd write it in a hurry. Spoke my mind to a fault. You know, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I created this image of somebody that was unapproachable unless you knew me. He was my teammate. But outsiders, no. I didn't want anything to do with you. I didn't care about you. Especially guys on another team. Even if I'd played with you before, I didn't want to talk to you. I did not want to. After the game, sure. Once we're out of uniform, yeah. But here at this ballpark, no. I don't know you.
That's not how it is now. Most fans love that. That, though, as you know, Alana, most fans will be like, I don't want them talking before the game.
100%. It's the old school way. That's what I still love it that way. You know, now it's like if you see your competition drowning, shove a hose in their mouth, that type of thing.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. Well, one of my best friends in baseball, still a really good friend of mine today, is a man named Jeff Grotewald. Definitely a guy you'd want in your foxhole. I got one. Get after it. Well, I had just gotten married. He had been married and had a kid, and we're in Venezuela, and we're in Zulia playing in the playoffs, in the Venezuela playoffs. He's playing for Zulia, and I'm playing for Magallanes. My wife comes in. We're staying with them at their place. My wife has just met him. I'm pitching that night. Jeff's the third hitter. He's the first baseman, big guy, home run hitter, that kind of guy. And he knows if I get ahead of him, he's out. So I throw a first pitch fastball on outside park plate, and he gets out of the ballpark. Well, he's laughing at me when he goes to first base. He's laughing. I meet him at third base, and I spit on him. He stops. He looks at me. He says, "Spit on me." I said, "Yeah, when you come up next time, I'm going to hit you right in the middle of the back." Next time that he comes up, I drill him right in the middle of the back. Well, yeah, the game's over, and he and I meet in the tunnel, and we're walking out of the field. And my wife comes up to me and says, "Did you spit on him?" I'm like, "Yep." He said, "I shouldn't have laughed." She said, "Did you hit him on purpose?" I'm like, "Yep." He said, "I shouldn't have laughed." That was it. That's how we played. But yeah, you don't see a whole lot of it nowadays. You know, it's not my game. It's their time. It's their turn. It's their game. You know, they're gonna live. They're gonna play it how they want to. It's just. I remember in the minor leagues, heck, we fought once a week with somebody. And we did. There's teams we loathe either the Tigers and the Yankees minor league teams. We fought every time we saw each other. On the field, off field, it didn't matter. We just didn't like each other. You know, and when I got the Phillies, Dickie Thon was our shortstop. And Dickie Thon is the nicest, most compassionate human being on the planet. Just a pleasure to be around. It then and now. But during that game, Dickie would take your head off. I remember him challenging the whole Mets dugout. Tell him he's going to meet him after the game. It's just the way we played. There was a switch you turned on when you got to the ballpark. This is your team. This is your family. This is who you're going to battle with. Ain't nobody else.
Yeah, that's a very different that switch is broken in today's game. You mentioned something, Jason, that I think is so relatable, not just to Major League Baseball players, but to professional athletes in general. Once that game is done, whether you have decided it's done or it's taken away from you, there is a hole in you that cannot be filled by anything, regardless of what you try to fill it with. What is your message to guys that are either going through that now, guys or girls, either going through that now or will go through it when their career is over?
Prepare. The people around you are going to be extremely important, because every person that plays a game for a living for any amount of time, there's going to be an ending to it, and it's something they've done and trained for probably on a daily basis their entire lives. Mm-hmm. And not only is the game gone, but your teammates are gone. Your support system that was there is gone. Now you got to rely on your family, who you don't really know that well because you haven't been around them that much. Your wife, your kids, whoever. And have a plan, prepare, and I'm going to beat this drum till the day Lord decides to take me. Your faith is going to be extremely important. If that isn't there, you're going to be lost in more than one sense of the word. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not easy. It's going to hurt. It's going to be painful. As much joy as you got out of playing, the pain that you're going to experience when it's gone is going to be just as bad, if not worse. And you just got to get mentally ready for it, because nobody's immune. It's going to happen.
Right.
Yeah, it's crazy. We talk to so many players and often go over that question. And some are anxiously awaiting, you know, 5 to 10 hobbies, jobs, opportunities, things they've wanted to pursue. And then to me, you know, your unofficial count, Jason, it's almost like your 50-50 split of, I don't know, I haven't thought about it, you know, and that often can cause a lot of thoughts going through the head, right? Where it's like, where's my place now? What's my purpose? Obviously, limelight. It's a drastic change. Do you think there's anything that can be done to help that transition? Obviously, you know, maybe it's more mentors, some type of program. I mean, technically, you know, we work with the Players Alumni Association and they do a great job on just connecting dots as much as possible. Like if you want to reach someone, and, you know, it's an association that basically every player is or can be in if they played, they can get a hold of someone and say, hey, you know, especially on the front of, hey, I see that you own a car dealership and I'm really interested in cars. I always love them. Can you give me advice? But the other side of it is, hey, are there people that can be reached out to where a player goes, I have no idea what I'm doing. I never thought about it. My entire life has revolved around a game. I don't even think about anything else until just now when I'm 34 years old and I'm lost. You know, how can that transition be better supported for players that need it?
Well, I think that needs to be part of the process when kids are drafted. When you get to the minor leagues, when you're drafted by a team, you've already invested the majority of your life before that to the game. And kids that are playing college, they're going through the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just you get drafted, now that moment has been postponed, but it's coming. I just think there'd be a better way to prepare these kids that are coming into the game to because, and you said something a little bit earlier, you can have all the numbers and outreaches you want, but when you get a top A individual that's used to doing everything on their own and is self-reliant, self-sufficient, and saying, okay, you need help, here's a number, call them. that's not really going to happen. Mm-hmm. I can fix this. I can do it myself. I can take care of this. No, you realize in a hurry you can't. I think it could be a better, you know, they have the rookie program now that all these kids go to. And I think a big part of it would be getting them prepared And having guys like myself, you know, Daryl Strawberry, whoever is out there that's gone through the pit, so to speak, to be able to talk to them about what's going to happen if you're not prepared and where you're going to end up, because that's a road that a lot of professional athletes go down. You know, I think 80% of 90% of marriages end in divorce real quick. I know addiction, alcoholism, even suicide rates are up.
Yeah.
I just think professional sports need to do, as a whole, need to do a better job right when those kids get in there, to explain to them, and not just in passing, hey, you're not always going to play, you know that. You know, just I think there could be a better job of preparing them, being able to face it. And not only that, resources with, like I said, guys like myself or George McGovern with the chapel leader with the Yankees, the other chapel leaders across baseball or across different sports, you know, businessmen that basically just a group of mentors to be able to have access to, where these guys can fill them with their experiences, not just talking out of a book and saying, okay, if you do this, 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 gonna be right, but actually real life experiences that guys like myself have experienced because of a lack of a plan or because of not preparing for it or whatever the reason may be, of what's going to happen, where they're going to end up, and what it's going to do to them.
Jason, how much do you think the journey from ruin to restoration, which you guys talk about in the book, is about forgiveness of yourself and apologizing to those that you felt you wronged?
Oh, a lot of it. But you know, it's still, even today, I close my eyes and memories will hit me, and you just sort of shudder. Yeah, but yeah, I still have stuff to forgive myself, some of the things that I put people through. But you know, that's a daily struggle I live with. But I know I'm not fighting alone right now. There's no doubt in my mind between my God, my family, and the people I've surrounded myself with, and the people that I'm reaching out to, the men's homes that I've gone and talked to, the churches that I've spoken at, it means as much to me as it does to them. But I had a problem a long time going to church and listening to pastors sit up there trying to tell me what to do, and they've never experienced some of the things I've experienced. Mm-hmm. And I think that experience, what I experienced, would I change anything in my life before? Yeah, there's a lot of things I would change. The people that I hurt, different things like that. But everything else that happened to me, no. So the drug addiction, the in and out of rehab, psych wards, would I change any of that? No. Because I would not be the man I am today had I not survived that or went through that. To be able to speak from experience to because when I get up and talk to somebody in a rehab facility, or they know I'm not talking from a book standpoint.
Right.
An academic standpoint. I'm speaking from, I lived it, gentlemen. I can tell you what, I know exactly what you're feeling. I know what you're going through. I know the thoughts that are going through your head. I know the solutions that you have in your head right now that are wrong. I can speak to this. And as soon as I found someone that was able to speak to me in that manner, you know, I'm not going to listen to somebody that hasn't experienced something.
Yeah.
Yeah, the impact's going to be made from people like you who can really go one-on-one with someone as well, like you mentioned in one of the prior stories with us, you know, someone that's going through what they feel like is a moment that could end their life, to speak with someone like you again. We appreciate having people like you that are sharing your story. We're also fortunate to have you still on this planet, as you mentioned earlier, Jason. So here's what I want to do. Okay. Cause I'm like a, Milana will tell you, like a funsy, try and spin some, you know, we got intense, right, for a while, and that's what we need to do. But you are full of just incredible, wild, and some scary and dangerous stories, obviously, many of which will be shared in the book if people want to check it out. So I want to do this. So my last question is going to be multiple choice in terms of how you want to answer, because I know that all of this is probably in the book too. I'm going to pick two stories and you can tell either one of them, and then obviously the other they can find out in the book. Or an option three is, hey, I've got an even crazier one in terms of, you know, that's worth telling and for people to listen to. So my two that stick out when I'm looking at them are plane crashes into your home, insane, into your home. Nobody on your side, on your family was hurt, fortunately. That's one. Number two is, and Alana mentioned it earlier, scaling the outside of a hotel at 3 a.m. And then number three is none of the above. I've got one that's, you know, even more wild to tell. So the floor is yours.
Well, this, I think it was January 25th, 2005. We were in Kansas City, and in the off season every morning I'd get up and I'd take my boys to school, and I drove them to school, and I dropped them off about 8:30, and my truck was making a horrible noise on the driver's side front tire. So I called my buddy at the Chevrolet dealership, and he said, yeah, bring it by real quick, I'll take a look at it. So from my house to where the boys went to school is about 10 minutes. And from where the boys went to school to the dealership was about another 10 minutes. And so I'm about 20 minutes away from the house. Well, I pull up at the Chevrolet dealership. My wife calls me on the phone, and in an unbelievably calm voice says, Jason, a plane hit the house. Rain and I are okay. You need to get home. So I didn't say what. I didn't question her. I got the keys from my buddy, hopped in my truck, and I got a 20-minute drive, and I made it about 10 minutes. I broke the law known to man to get into the house. And when I pull into the neighborhood, they had the neighborhood blocked off with emergency vehicles. Well, I drove through the ditch and drove around them. And I get close to my house, and they had the road blocked off. I drove around that roadblock and had to drive up in my front yard. Well, I get out of my truck, and I'm going to the front door, and one of the officers that was there, I knew from the stadium. He worked security at the stadium in Kansas City. And he said, Jason, you can't go in there. I said, dude, you're going to shoot me. It's my house. So I go through the front door, and I'm hollering for my wife and my daughter, and walk through the living room. I go in the kitchen, and we had a room off the kitchen, the keeping area, and the glass was gone. The walls were gone. The back patio door was gone. The wall was gone there. Still couldn't find my wife and my daughter. Walked out on the back patio, and there were five people that lost their lives that day. And when I walked on the back patio, I saw things that I wish I could unsee. And I'm not going to go in detail, but I'll never forget the sight, but I'll never forget the smell either. So I turn around, I come back in the house, and by that time, the officer that was chasing me through the house caught up to me and said, hey, they're across the street, they're fine. And I went over there, my wife and my daughter and a friend of ours that was my wife's personal trainer, they were downstairs in the basement when the plane hit. And there's jet fuel everywhere. the first truck that I ever owned was a 1985 Nissan four-wheel drive pickup truck. It was cut in half by one of the engines. There wasn't much left of the plane. But as far as timing goes, if my truck hadn't made that noise, that room that the majority of the wreckage tore through, my daughter and I would have been sitting there watching one of her shows while I had a cup of coffee, which I did every morning, while Dana went downstairs with Miranda. And it was a horrible thing. Five people lost their lives. It was just a tragic event. But it was one of those moments where, you know, I'm not going to say God had his hand in it. You know, who's God? Who am I to say God protected me and not them? But it's just my truck hadn't made that noise. There'd have been two other people that added that list of casualties that day. I had made that noise before and it didn't make that noise after.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. You have so many amazing stories to tell. That's just one of the amazing ones. And I love that you're continuing to give back, not only because of the experience that only you can tell, but also what this book is going to do for so many others, not only that read it, Jason, but the proceeds of what you're doing it, because all of the proceeds, not just a portion, full proceeds benefit Emerging Grace Ministries and their ongoing efforts to help eradicate adolescent sex trafficking. And I know why that, I know more about why that's important to you now than I did before we started this interview, because of what happened to you early on in your life. And we can't thank you enough for, again, I never thought I'd be talking to a two-time World Series champion and not even bring up 1999 and 2000. I mean, it's just so irrelevant to what the bigger picture is, but thank you for taking a minute to tell us your story. Again, you can get it out now. It's called Cross-Stitched, One Man's Journey from Ruin to Restoration. Jason doesn't leave any stone unturned. He wrote this with Jason Clark. It's out now. You can get it. And Jason, we're so thankful that you you didn't do a good job and you botched that attempt, my friend. Much more to tell and so much more to do on this earth. And I, for one, and I know obviously my colleague and friend Scott are incredibly grateful that you live to tell the story and the impact that you're having on so many others.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me. Thank you for giving me this this platform to be able to talk and to talk with you guys. And like you said, it's just I love these type of settings. I don't like suits and ties. I don't like sitting in front of a podium that much. I'll do it. Don't get me wrong. I'll do it. But, you know, I just love the familiarity with which you guys speak, and you're extremely comfortable to talk to really quick and early. And I just appreciate that, and appreciate, like I said, the opportunity to talk with you guys, and hopefully we get a chance to do it again.
No doubt. Yeah. A guy from East Texas doing big things. So grateful for you. Thank you so much, Jason. We appreciate you.
Thank you, guys. God bless you.
God bless you.
Well, told you, if you heard us at the beginning, you were going to be shell-shocked if you didn't know the story of Jason Grimsley, who, of course, the biggest part to me was I didn't realize this or hadn't seen anything in a pickup from the book. He, you know, attempted to end his life and luckily is still here now to share his story.
And so many near-death experiences in his life and so many unbelievably tragic things that have happened to him and could have legitimately ended him. But what I love about this story so much is his vulnerability and his willingness to tell everybody, you know what, I know I messed up, but there's an opportunity to literally and figuratively live to tell about it. And I applaud him for having the trust in his audience to allow him to tell what an unbelievably incredible story.
You can evolve as a person. You can change your personality. You can do a lot of things differently pretty quickly in life. I think that's something that he's done, right? He's like, I am not the same guy I was when I was a player.
And it is so difficult, I think, as professional athletes to even show any sort of softness, any sort of soft spot or vulnerability or weakness, for lack of a better term. And I think he is just proof that, you know what? Again, I've said it a million times on the lounge that they're human beings before they're people before they're players. And I think this was just such an amazing illustration of what Jason went through and honestly lived to tell about it. And I'm grateful for it. And I've gotten into the book. I'm about halfway through, and it's unbelievable what this man has gone through.
Yes, agreed. All right. So we're going to smoothly work our way over to This Week in Baseball and have some fun with this one. You know, season starting. Happy baseball season to everyone. So let's finish with a little spring training story, but it's March 27th, 2008, when Hideki Matsui, who had already made marriage plans in a few weeks, which the team hadn't known, he makes a wager with some of his teammates about who's going to get married first. So Derek Jeter falls for it. Bobby Abreu falls for it, and they do ultimately on this date agree to pay off the bet after learning that the Yankee slugger pulled a fast one on them. He did get hitched in New York on the club's off day the day before. So he had plans for it, and he was like, who's going to get married first? And they had no idea. And he was like, up. Pay up. Maybe
hey,
help
I
pay
did.
For some wedding
I got
plans.
Very, I think I feel like, I mean, it was 2008, so it's not like it's 1908, but I feel like there wasn't the advent of as much social media as there is now. So it's not as if, you know, the wives of the other players could have been following Hideki Matsui's fiance and known every single thing that's going on in their life. So he was able to pull a fast one over. He gets married and wins a bet. And you know what? Good for him.
I agree. I'm looking up now as we're talking. I believe Twitter was created in 2006, but it wasn't anything close to what it was now. I believe Instagram didn't exist. Obviously, no. Many of the others like the Snapchats
and TikToks. I didn't
even
get on Twitter, I don't think, until like 2011. I mean, I'm a billion years older than you. Now you can't breathe Scott Braun without it being known on Instagram, social media, every single move that people are making. So Hideki was smart to make that bet.
Yeah, he made money then that he couldn't have made now. So don't try this at home. It won't work. You'd have to be super secretive to pull something like this off, especially as a ball player.
As a New York Yankee.
A New York Yankee who's also coming from a country that is absolutely baseball crazed.
A baseball
crazed.
Every
move is documented by a separate group of media.
No doubt. Did you see when Team Japan got back to Japan after the World Baseball Classic here in 2023? I mean, it's bigger than anything that we can even consider here in the United States. It was unreal. They love their baseball in Japan.
Baseball is way bigger in Japan than it is here.
I'm
saying that as a compliment to Japan, not a knock on America.
Correct. I also say that over. The Japan won. Team USA didn't lose. It was just that Team Japan won. That's just how it went.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I mean, they're good. They're good at baseball. They're well prepared. The country's all over it. It means a ton to them. So
yes.
I'm with you. Props to Hideki. Hope he bought something nice with that. And he had some pretty hefty contracts during his playing years. So I think he did fine anyway.
No doubt.
Happy opening day, Alana, and to everyone listening inside the lounge. We're excited for another season with everyone. And if there's any players you want to hear from, by the way, hit us up on socials. Now Alana actually dominates on social, on Insta and Twitter.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That,
yeah, so. That blue check mark. Let's see how long that lasts. Well, thank you, everybody, for being with us. We appreciate it. Happy New Year. 2023 baseball season is upon us.
The Legends Lounge Podcast is brought to you by Major League Alumni Marketing. Hit us with questions or comments at legendslounge@mlbpaa.com. Check out our memorabilia at mlamauthentics.com. Later, Legends.